Thank you very much, Dick. Good afternoon to all of you. Today, it is my honor to introduce to you not one, but two American patriots and thank them for their service to our country. In addition to today's speaker, Professor Dennis Wilder, I'm delighted to also introduce his wife, Dr. Ursula Wilder, who is here with us today. Ursula is a clinical psychologist with 16 years of service to the intelligence community. She has spent countless hours interviewing and profiling the most notorious traitors who committed espionage against the U.S., men like Aldrich Ames, who for 9 years, it was a CIA case officer who for 9 years was a Russian mole in the CIA who revealed all our penetrations in Russia to the KGB and its successor, the FSB, all but one of whom I understand were executed. Another was Robert Hansen. Perhaps some of you have seen the movie, the 2007 movie, The Breach. Robert Hansen, for 9 years, worked for the Soviets and later the Russians, and he was in charge, he was at the FBI and in charge of counterintelligence, keeping track of foreign agents in the U.S. An unclassified version of her award-winning papers, The Psychology of Espionage, and more recently, Leaking in the Digital Age, are now available on the CIA website, cia.gov, so I recommend it to you. But today's speaker, Dennis, is currently a professor at Georgetown University. He comes by all this naturally. He grew up the son of Methodist missionaries in Southeast Asia, in the jungles. Ursula's parents had a better deal. They were Methodist missionaries in Europe. Dennis joined the CIA in 1980, and I first met him when he served as chief of China Analytic Studies in the Directorate of Intelligence. Not only did he brief me as ambassador, but he routinely briefed at least three presidents of the United States. In the second term of President Bush 43's administration, Dennis served as senior director for Asian affairs at the National Security Council, where he played an influential role in policymaking. After that, Dennis served for 6 years as senior editor of the Presidential Daily Brief. More recently, he was deputy assistant director of the CIA for East Asia and Pacific, responsible for operations as well as analysis. Without more, I'm delighted to give you the man who knows, Dennis Wilder.
Thank you, Sam. Well, let's see, are we on the right mic? Everybody can hear me?
Great.
We'll put that one down. We'll open my laptop here. Let me first say what a pleasure it is to be here in Florida. This is the first trip Ursula and I have made to Naples, and Sandy has been telling us how wonderful a place it is, and I think we may change our retirement plans pretty soon here. You all seem pretty happy with this part of the country. My life has been one of flying east-west, as Sandy said, and so coming north-south is a little different for me. I want to start today. Excuse me just a moment. Actually, after Sandy's buildup of Ursula, I thought, why isn't she speaking today instead of me? And probably there were a fair number of you who thought the same thing. Yeah, she reminds me that she has not put in the forms to speak publicly on the issues. What I wanted to do today is talk to you about rising China, our interests in the Indo-Pacific region, which is the new term that the Trump administration uses instead of East Asia, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But first, for our students here, I wanted to talk for a moment about how foreign policy is made and how some of the big things that we think about are actually not the things that make the difference. But there are smaller things that ambassadors do, that actually can be momentous in their own right. And in late 2005, President Bush was planning a trip to Beijing, Sandy will recall. And we were having trouble because, you'll recall, the war in Iraq, a lot of the American public felt that the image of the president was of a warrior. It was becoming a little bit negative. And so the National Security Advisor called me into his office one day and said, "Dennis, on this trip to Beijing, we want to humanize the president for the Chinese people. We want to make the president not just a man in suit, and no more of these men in suit events." Well, the Chinese aren't big on sort of spontaneous events. But we thought it through, and we realized that there was something the president did that was really fun. He mountain biked. So I told the National Security Advisor, "Well, I can try and see what we can do with mountain biking." And he said, "Absolutely, call Sandy." So I called Ambassador Rant and I said, "Sandy, you got to go to the Chinese and see if we can get out there and have the president mountain bike with the Chinese Olympic team." I said, "I've looked at the satellite photos and I think there's a mountain bike trail to the west of Beijing." And Sandy, of course, in his usual size, said, "I'll get right on it." And he went to the Chinese, and indeed, at a place called Laoshan, there was a mountain bike trail, only it hadn't been finished yet. So he explained to the Chinese what needed to be done. The Chinese were a little uncomfortable with this idea. But finally, they said, okay, and they sent 10,000 PLA soldiers out to build the mountain bike trail just so the President of the United States could take a ride. Which, great credit to Sandy for that. However, the night before the event, I was sitting having dinner with Carl Rove and Steve Hadley and a few other people. And Carl Rove gave me one of his steely looks across the table. And he said, "Be it on your head if tomorrow the President of the United States crashes on that course." So naturally, I went to my room and had a night where every 5 minutes I could see the president crashing dramatically and The Economist having a cover story about president crashes in China. And of course I said to myself, why did Sandy talk me into this? Now, in actual fact, the president did make the course, did a brilliant job, was with the Chinese Olympic team on that course. I will tell you that one Secret Service agent fell. The military aide cut his chin open. But the president did make it through the course. And I knew we had had a successful event because I was with a cab driver the next morning. And spontaneously, the man turned to me and he said, "Your president is fierce. Our leaders would never think of going out and doing something that daring and that bold." So I knew that Sandy had done something for U.S.-China relations that day, and there were many moments like that when Sandy, who truly was one of the best ambassadors we have ever had in China, helped to advance the relationship. But you didn't invite me here to tell war stories, so I'll stop with those at this point. What you did invite me here, hopefully, to talk about is U.S. policy in the Indo-Pacific region. And there are a lot of things we could talk about today, but really, for the United States in the last few years and today, the key issue is what we call getting China right. China is at the center of a rising Asia. And China has changed. China is no longer the sick man of East Asia, as we all know, but rather the world's second most powerful economic force, moving quickly up the the ladder of economics and building a sizable military. So the question is not one of whether China is going to be a competitor to the United States. China is now a competitor of the United States. China is now a rival of the United States. The key question for all of us is, what kind of competitor do we have in East Asia? What kind of relationship do we build with this new China? And I like to use a sports analogy when I talk about this. You can compete in a tennis game where you have very set rules, where you shake hands at the end of the match, where it's a gentlemanly sport, no one gets hurt. You can also have a boxing match. And you can have a boxing match with either rules or without rules, and you can either be trying to score points on your opponent or you can try to be knocking them down. So I think the consensus in Washington on China has shifted some, and I'll talk about the reasons for this in just a moment. And that shift is that we have to accept that we are going to have both a cooperative and competitive relationship with this nation. The question is the balance. The question is, as I said, getting it right. There will be cooperation with China. There are many issues, and I'll talk about a couple of them, that we have to work with the Chinese on. But there is some competition. This is a bit of a change from earlier times when I think people thought we could have a completely cooperative relationship with the Chinese government. Certainly, if you look back at the Clinton administration, they talked about strategic partnership with the Chinese. And there was a belief that we were moving China in the right direction. But since President Xi Jinping came to power in China in about 2012, it's been a little bit of a setback, I have to tell you, in terms of that view of China. Why? You have to understand, and of course my wife, the clinical psychologist, helps me understand that people come from their backgrounds, right? We all come from places where we started and our formative years. If you look at President Xi Jinping, there are several things you need to understand about him. Number one, he is a crown prince of China. What do I mean by crown prince? It means that his father joined Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao's revolution in the 1920s. And actually, when Mao took the Long March and his revolutionary forces were decimated by Chiang Kai-shek's army, he came up to Yan'an in western China. One of the men who greeted him there, one of the men who gave him refuge, was Xi Jinping's father. So Xi Jinping is no ordinary Chinese. And in fact, his whole life, unlike in the American system, and the Chinese are fond of telling us this, they build leaders. They build leaders from a young age. Some of the children, he was actually sent to the countryside as a young man, suffered during the Cultural Revolution, and some who went to the countryside became rather anti-communist. But he became redder than red. He is a true believer in the communist system. He believes in one-party authoritarian rule. And just to give you a quick story to show you just how dedicated he was to it, when he was a young man, he married a woman who was the daughter of the Chinese ambassador to the UK. In about 1982, she said, "Let's move to England." He said, "Let's get divorced." And he divorced her. And instead, he married Madame Peng, who was in the Chinese military as one of the most famous singers of China. In fact, she was more famous than he was at that point in time. The point I'm trying to make is he built a career, he thought things through, and one of the reasons he married Madame Peng, because we all know as gentlemen that our wives are secret weapons for us at points in our careers, she was his secret weapon. She knew everything about the Chinese armed forces. So when he moved into a position where he could take over China in about 2012, he used her knowledge of the PLA and the generals and their corruption to go after them. Because she had sung as a song and dance troupe leader in every one of their military headquarters all over the country. And she'd gone to banquets every night with them. She knew these guys. And she knew who was naughty and nice. And she had an incredible influence on his career. She has built his power base with the Chinese military. And he took a page out of the playbook of a former Chinese leader, Deng Xiaoping, who realized that if you were going to control China, the thing you needed on your side was the security services and the military. Consequently, he's been good to the military. He's given them a lot. He also believes that the rejuvenation, he calls it, of China means that you have to build China's military force. What that means for us today in East Asia is that for the first time since 1945, we have a navy in East Asia that can compete with ours. And they have ideas of what their area of the Pacific is. And it goes out to what they call the second island chain beyond Japan. We're going to have to figure out between the United States and China how we deal with that question. You may have heard about what they've been doing in the South China Sea, where they have engaged in an incredible building project, where they have taken artificial reefs and built them into military bases with airfields on them. It is one of the most amazing land reclamation projects I have ever seen. The satellite photos of these things are unbelievable. But he did that in part because they want to establish their primacy in the South China Sea, but also because he wanted the pride that came with it. What he is trying to build is a China on a nationalistic base. And that is going to be something of a problem for us and is a problem for us today in dealing with China. The second aspect that any American president has to deal with Xi Jinping, is, of course, his economic policies. You've all been well-schooled in this through the election that there is the claim by the president and his minions that since China joined the WTO, we have lost 5 million manufacturing jobs and China is to blame. Well, there's no question that we've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs since that time. But there are a lot more complicated reasons than just China to the question of why we lost manufacturing jobs in this country. Also, even if some of those and some were lost to China, there's no question about it because of the cheap labor the Chinese have, we also failed in this country, frankly, to help those workers. In Europe, as China took some of those manufacturing jobs, the Europeans, I have to say, were much better at retraining people than we were. And our retraining programs for our blue-collar workers were not robust. That's one problem. And obviously, the president has talked about how we need to rebalance the trade relationship, that we have to get a better deal from the Chinese. One of the reasons, though, that the economic relationship has soured is because in Xi Jinping's nationalism, he has moved in a retrograde fashion on some of the reforms that China promised under the World Trade Organization when they joined. So, for example, today when I go to Beijing and try and use my Visa card, it doesn't work in about, 7 out of 10 places that I try and use it. Chinese have promised us 4 times to fix this. But why do they keep Visa out? Because they don't want the competition. Their banks in China want to keep the Chinese market for credit cards with the Chinese banks. And this is a problem in the trading relationship. As Ambassador Rant knows, who now works for various Chinese or U.S. corporations dealing business in China, Americans have soured a little bit on China because of this, because of forced attempts to get American companies to give their trade secrets to Chinese companies, stealing of IPR in China. And so the latest American Chamber of Commerce survey of China shows that today 81% of American firms feel less welcome than ever before in China, and that figure has grown over recent years quite dramatically. Now, the Trump administration is trying something called the Comprehensive Economic Dialogue to deal with these issues, but those talks have stalled. And on the president's desk right now are several proposals to retaliate against the Chinese on the trade front. There are concerns that those proposals could lead to a trade war. I am not sure what the president's going to do on this issue. It is a difficult one to parse out, and I think that we are at a point, though, where in 2018 you could see the trading relationship become much more difficult and some steps on both sides to retaliate. That said, we are locked into a relationship with China on the economic side. We import billions of dollars every day of Chinese goods in this country. And American consumers have done extremely well off of that. If you look at Walmart Corporation, one American corporation, and the amount of goods it receives into this country from China, it is incredible. And those have kept inflation low in many ways. They've helped the American worker, particularly blue-collar workers who haven't had their salaries raised very much over the last few years, to continue to buy consumer goods at a relatively cheap rate. But I talked about these are the competitive aspects I wanted to talk about, but then there are the areas where we need China, where the United States needs China and China needs the United States. And the key one, of course, at the moment that you've all read about is Korea. The Korean problem is a real problem. It is a problem that successive American administrations have been unable to solve. And I tell you, as a member of the Bush White House, we weren't able to figure out a way out of the conundrum. The difficulty, to sum it up in a short fashion, is that the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, is bound and determined to have nuclear weapons capable of striking the United States of America, Japan, South Korea. He believes that his legacy is to reunite the Korean Peninsula. And the concern in the Trump administration and around Washington is that if he achieves this capability, not that he's going to necessarily strike the United States, but that he's going to blackmail South Korea, that he is going to find a way to use this new capability to force the South Korean government into some sort of reunification against their will. Now, last year, he started testing missiles with a lot more range than anything we'd ever seen before. He did it in an interesting fashion, and I won't go into all the science of this, but he basically lofted the missiles straight up and brought them down in the Sea of Japan, instead of firing them out into the Pacific Ocean. The reason he did that is because we in the Bush administration built something called the Ballistic Missile Defense Shield. And we have, in Alaska, interceptor missiles that if those missiles were to fly in the direction of the United States, the Strategic Command would have to make a decision on whether or not to fire at them. We have 44 interceptors today. The president has just called for creating 20 more of those interceptor missiles. Frankly, we don't know if that shield would work. And when you think about this, think about two things. One, what countries in the world today can strike the United States with a nuclear weapon? Well, let's go through the list. I'm pretty certain our British friends aren't going to fire a missile at the United States. I'm less sure, but I'm pretty hopeful that the French won't be firing missiles at the United States. Sorry, Ursula. I know you lived in France, I know. But I'm a poor Asian. I don't know what I'm talking about on that score. We have understandings with the Russians and the Chinese. We have an understanding on mutual assured destruction with them. But the country we have no understandings with and don't know what will happen with is North Korea. It is the only other one that could strike us with nuclear weapons. Moreover, Ursula always tells me not to say that leaders are either crazy or not crazy, because I can't really do a clinical diagnosis of these people. But what I can tell you about Kim in North Korea is he is one brutal guy. Let's look at his record. He sunk a South Korean destroyer, killing 46 South Korean sailors for no good reason, except he wanted to prove that he was a tough guy. His uncle, who his father put there to help him learn the ropes, he killed with anti-aircraft guns. Not just a bullet, but 14.5-millimeter quad-4 anti-aircraft guns, so that there was no body left at the end of the process. And he's done that with many of the people he worried about and worried that they would be against him. Third, as you all probably noticed, in Kuala Lumpur Airport, his agents used VX gas, which is banned and has not been used since World War I, to kill his half-brother because he felt that his half-brother could be used by the Chinese to be a successor. This is a man not to be trusted. This is a man who we really have to look out for, and we have to find a way to deal with the threat that he poses. Now, the administration has decided, I think rightly, to use what is called a policy of maximum pressure on the North Koreans. What we have done with the Chinese is say to them, look, you don't need the problems this guy is causing you. You don't want him to be a nuclear power. You don't want him to destabilize Northeast Asia, in part because if he destabilizes Northeast Asia, we will put more and more American forces into the region, and that's not something in your interest. So the administration, I have to give them a lot of credit, has moved the Chinese quite a bit on this issue. The latest UN sanctions on the North Koreans are impressive, and they are starting to bite. Will he give up his nuclear weapons? I don't know. But I do know that we have to try. I don't think, as some have wanted, that we can simply talk about a containment strategy in Northeast Asia. And the reason is, again, because I think this is an unpredictable leader. I also think you have to think about the fact that when you put this economic pressure on him, he could well try and sell his nuclear weapons to someone else. And we don't want that kind of proliferation in the world. So I think that the maximum pressure campaign of this administration is actually having some effect. Recently, you may have read that the North Koreans have agreed to come to the Olympic Games in South Korea in February. That talks have reopened. I think that is in part because of the pressure we've put on the North Koreans. So I think that is a positive development in our relationship with China, and it does show that there are areas like North Korea, like terrorism, several other areas. I don't think that the China-U.S. relationship has to turn into, as I said, a negative competition, but can remain a healthy competition. Now, one new U.S. idea that has been floated recently by the President and by Secretary Tillerson is that we think about East Asia a little bit differently, that we talk about it as the Indo-Pacific, and they have talked about the idea of a free and open Indo-Pacific. I actually like this idea very much. because it speaks to our like-minded values with people in East Asia and South Asia. In other words, as India comes up as a great power and is a democracy, we should include it in this sphere. And it is useful as a counterbalance to Chinese power in the region. Similarly, a good relationship with Japan. One of the things that I have believed in, and we believed in the Bush administration, and I'm happy to see the Trump administration return to, is the idea that you work China from the outside in. In other words, you do not base your strategy in this region on the world of just bilateral relations. You make sure the alliances in East Asia are strong, that you work with the like-minded countries of this region, and as China's power grows, you balance that with these very strong countries in East Asia, all the way from Australia to the Southeast Asian little dragons. I think this is very wise. I guess I'd end on a very, what I think is a positive note, which is American values are still loved in the world. President Trump has made some mistakes. Frankly, I think that the decision to pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a self-inflicted wound by the United States because that was a way to balance Chinese economic power in East Asia. And I really cannot explain why we thought this was the right thing to do. I also think that the slogan America First is terrific inside the United States and just miserable to defend outside of the United States. The president tried in Vietnam to explain America First. I'm not sure it worked out very well because it looks terribly self-centered as an American policy. But I think our values are still strong in the world. I think the American armed forces are the best in the world, and the Chinese are not going to be our peer competitor anytime soon. Our businesses, our innovation, our young people, we have tremendous advantages on the Chinese. We don't need to be fearful of this competition with the Chinese. We just need to keep it a healthy competition. And I will stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dennis, for that insightful talk. We have some questions for you now. And the first one comes from one of our students today. What are the American-South Korean relations like, and how does that impact the situation with North Korea? Very good question.
That's a very good question. The South Koreans obviously are on the front lines of this situation with the North. And they very much recognize the dangers that the North poses and have lived with that threat ever since the Korean War. Remember that we only have an armistice in Korea. We have never had peace in Korea. And so the South Korean people have lived with that for years and years. If you meet South Koreans, they will tell you how appreciative they are of the United States. Over and over again, I have met with South Koreans who talked about being children at the time of the war, having their families killed, and then having American soldiers come in and take care of them. There is a very strong bond between the American and Chinese people. Our difficulty with the South Korean governments comes, frankly, at moments exactly like this. The North Korean leader has now finally, for the first time since he was in power, actually reached out to the South Koreans and said, I want to talk. The South Koreans then have to make some decisions about how far they go. Do they offer him incentives? Do they try and build the relationship? And of course, there are politicians in South Korea who are forward-leaning on this, who want to try and solve this problem before it gets to war. Washington, on the other hand, is far more skeptical and wary of these moves because it looks as if the North Korean leader, and I think this is, of course, part of his game, is trying to split the United States and South Korea. So it's a tricky thing. The U.S. South Korean relationship has to be very carefully nurtured. We have to keep understanding each other on these issues. Otherwise, the North Korean leader will find a way to split the South from us, and then we get these problems that we've seen in the past where Washington is very uncomfortable with where a South Korean government is headed. So it's an excellent question, because it takes constant work to keep our alliance strong and together.
Thank you. The next question. We had several questions, by the way, about the TPP, but I think Professor Wilder's already answered those. Please comment about the Chinese One Belt, One Road project, the Silk Road project.
Excellent, yeah. They now call it the Belt and Road Initiative. They keep changing the name. It used to be the Silk Road, and now it's called Belt and Road Initiative. This is a concept that the Chinese have of helping nations on their periphery with infrastructure development, which is actually a very positive thing. If the Chinese are willing to use their capital to help neighboring states in Central Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia build their economies, we can be supportive of that, and should be. The difficulty comes with how the Chinese provide capital to these countries. One of the first examples of this was Sri Lanka, where the Chinese poured money in, but at usury rates, and the Sri Lankan government could not pay them back, and now the Chinese have taken ports and other things in Sri Lanka as sort of collateral for these bad loans. If China is going to play the game with its neighbors that way, we cannot be supportive of it, obviously. But it speaks to one of the problems we have, because these countries are in need, and their need of infrastructure development. I think the IMF said $8 billion or more of infrastructure development is needed pretty immediately across the region. And unfortunately, the United States has backed away from a lot of this kind of activity. We do not support the Asian Development Bank at a level, I think, that we should. We have somehow found that foreign aid is a dirty subject. And we're now down to 1%, I believe, of our national budget is spent on foreign aid, and most of that, frankly, goes to Egypt and Israel. I have no problem giving it to Egypt and Israel, but I'd like to see the figure go up, because I think we have to compete with the Chinese in this field, for the good of American business and for the good of these countries. Because the Chinese do, at times, have a mercantilist approach to their trading relationships. And so we're watching in Washington the Belt and Road very closely. Secretary Tillerson has spoken to the Chinese about this, and we've tried to encourage them to use fair market principles, open and transparent contracting in the Belt and Road Initiative. But it's a work in progress and something that we have to watch closely.
The next is two questions put together, and one of them is from the student. They're about Kim Jong-un. One must be from a doctor here who says it seems he has hypertension, he's clearly obese, and has diabetes. How's his health? And from the students, is he a rational actor?
Yes. I'll let my wife answer the second one. No. First of all, rational actor, sure. He's a rational actor from his point of view. His point of view is that we brought down Gaddafi in Libya when he gave up his weapons of mass destruction, or his program of weapons of mass destruction, that we bring down other countries in the world when they are weak, and therefore he has to be strong. The difficulty I have with that is, since 1950, we have never threatened North Korea. But North Korea certainly has threatened South Korea over and over again. So who's the aggressor here? So while it may be rational from his point of view because of the sanctions we put on that he feels defensive, I think the facts speak otherwise. We are ready to negotiate with the North Koreans. We were ready in the Bush administration. We did negotiate with them. But every time we've come to an agreement with the North Koreans, they have cheated on those agreements. And that is the huge frustration of dealing with this regime. As to his health, he does a lot of unhealthy things. One of them he does, and if I had a slide I could show you, he tends to smoke his cigarettes next to his missiles. I've often thought we should send him packs of cigarettes so that he can continue to do this. He is unhealthy, terribly unhealthy. You may know that North Koreans drink heavily and live in the elites of North Korea, pretty poor lifestyles. So, but again, I'm not exactly wanting to put him on a fitness program. I think change in North Korea would not be the most terrible thing I can think about.
Thank you. In that regard, is there a viable successor to him in North Korea?
Ah, the successors. You will not be surprised that a guy who comes from the CIA has thought about successors in North Korea. We think a lot about that subject. There are several people that are very interesting possibilities. One is he actually, his father's brother, his uncle, is the North Korean ambassador in the Czech Republic. Now, you'll understand that this man keeps a very low profile because he's a little concerned about what his nephew might think if he had a higher profile. In fact, the story is that he was the ambassador in Poland for North Korea, but he had been there so long that he was about to become the dean of the corps, and his nephew said, well, no. So he moved him to Czechoslovakia so he would move down so that he would be lower profile in the world. But he certainly is a possibility because it would succession in North Korea almost certainly, at least at the beginning, would be another member of the family. Also, his half-brother has a son who's about 22 years old who lives in China. There are reports, unconfirmed, that he tried to send a hit squad after him as well and that the Chinese are protecting him. So it isn't that there couldn't be people that you could see the North Korean military rally around if either they thought Kim was going to do something disastrous or if Kim died. And so there are people. But I think we'd have to say that the chances that we would change from a totalitarian regime to something else immediately are very low. It would probably be a member of the family, hopefully a little less aggressive, who would take over, at least initially, with the support of the military in North Korea.
Thank you. Perhaps the last question. Will our recent squabble with Pakistan, where we are withholding some aid because of Pakistan not aggressively helping us with terrorists, affect our relationship with China?
I actually have a research project underway at Georgetown in what we call our U.S.-China initiative on South Asia, because I think that South Asia is an area of the world where actually U.S. and Chinese interests overlap in a positive way. The Chinese, as you may know, are very worried about Islamic extremism in Western China. There is a group called the Uyghurs in Western China who are Muslim. They are ethnically different from the Han Chinese people. And some of them have been radicalized. In fact, when we sent many people from Afghanistan to Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, to be incarcerated, there were many Chinese Uyghurs among that group. So the Chinese interest in South Asia is instability. It is in having those countries find a way to become prosperous and stable. So I think that we should be working harder at working with China on South Asia issues. Pakistan is a tough, tough thing. The difficulty we have with Pakistan is that they really do see some of these terrorist organizations as in their interest. And this has been an ongoing problem for American administrations. Is cutting off the aid the right answer? I'm not sure. The difficulty is, once you cut off aid to a country like Pakistan, do you ever get your influence back again? Because then they turn other places. Again, I am a great believer in foreign aid. You know, many of you will remember well the Marshall Plan, how well we did after World War II at helping to revive the nations, not only of Europe, but Japan, South Korea, others in the East Asian sphere. I think we need to get back to some of that. We need to realize that everything can't be done with military power, and that if you're going to have a foreign policy that's balanced, yes, of course you need a strong military, but you also need those other tools of economic diplomacy that I think we've sort of lost sight of in recent years. Thanks very much.
Dennis, thank you very much. I think that was terrific. Very informative. Dennis, I'm...